My guest, Dana Gioia, is the first poet to head the National Endowment for the Arts. He was chosen by President George W. Bush and assumed office early this year. Gioia's book of poems, Interrogations at Noon, published 2 years ago, included excerpts of the libretto he wrote for the opera Nosferatu. He's also the author of the controversial 1991 essay, Can Poetry Matter?, in which he argued that the cultural importance of poetry was declining, in part because poets were writing for other poets and academics. Before Gioia made a living through his writing, he worked as a vice president of General Foods, where he oversaw the marketing of Kool-Aid and Jell-O, including the Jell-O Jigglers campaign. As part of his work at the NEA, he's initiated a nationwide tour of Shakespeare's works performed by 6 theater companies. In the interest of full disclosure, I should mention that Fresh Air receives partial funding from the NEA. I asked Dana Gioia to sum up the arguments he made in his 1991 essay, Can Poetry Matter?, and to reflect on where poetry fits in American culture today.
My essay, Can Poetry Matter?, started with a cultural paradox, which was that never in the history of humanity had a nation, you know, spent, as it were, so much money to have people profess poetry, to create this official culture of poetry. And yet, never in the history of humanity had there seemed to be a nation in which poetry mattered less among the educated people. And so it seemed to me that there was some sort of cultural disconnect between the what I call the subculture of poetry and the general culture. And I talked about ways in which the power of poetry, the power of this primal human art, could be reconnected to general American society. The poetry world has changed rather dramatically. You now have across the United States civic-based poetry festivals. You have readings commonly in bookstores. You have poetry on the radio. These things have all been very effective ways of building the audience for poetry and taking the conversation that is culture and involving not merely the specialists in it, but the non-specialist.
Poets have to figure out how to make a living because they're probably not going to make it from the poems themselves. Only a few lucky poets are able to actually do that. So many poets teach, and I think that's one of the reasons why many poets teach. Your solution to that question was to work in the corporate world for about 15 years. You were a vice president at General Foods. You ended up being a product manager for Country Time Lemonade, and you worked for Kool-Aid. Did you think of yourself as a marketing expert who wrote poetry or as a poet who needed a day job, or were you able to think of yourself as both at the same time?
Well, I always tried to put in an honest day's work and all too frequently an honest evening's work too, but I am probably the only human being who's ever gone to Stanford Business School to be a poet. I was at graduate school at Harvard, and I realized that I wanted to be a poet and that the university would not necessarily be the best place to do that, that I was being trained in some ways to write about literature and talk about literature in a way that not everyone could understand, and that, in fact, the very people that I came from, you know, I'm a working-class kid from L.A., were not really able to understand the way that I spoke about literature at the university. My parents are wonderful people, but they neglected to give me the private income I so richly deserved, and so I had to make a living somehow. And I decided that, you know, in the tradition of Wallace Stevens and T.S. Eliot and other American poets, that I would get a job in business. And so I went into the business world specifically to be a writer, and I made myself a promise that I would work on my writing every day. And indeed, I did that for the next 17 years.
How'd you find the time to do it?
With great difficulty. But I would come back, and every night, no matter how tired I was, you know, I would try to read or write for 2 hours. And it was hard to do, but I found that a phenomenon I'd noticed when I used to run track happened also at your desk, which is called the second wind. No matter how tired I was, I'd say, well, let me just recopy by hand the paragraph or the stanza that I'd written the night before. And as I began to do that, new ideas would come up, and by the end of that little copying exercise, I would find myself re-engaged back into the work.
Gee, what a kind of pleasant and easy transition into starting to write for the day or the night.
Well, I think you should always leave yourself a doorway back into your art. I found that it was important even when I became a full-time writer, because until I became the chairman of the National Endowment for the Arts, the previous 11 years I supported myself and my family as a writer. And it was always nice to have something that was sort of slightly incomplete, left over from the day before, that wasn't too hard to begin.
I understand that in the 15 years that you worked in the corporate world, you kept your poetry a secret. And the fact that you were published was something that your co-workers, your colleagues, didn't really know. Why did you feel the need to keep that secret?
Well, I didn't think it would do me any good in a very competitive, old-fashioned company to be known as the corporate poet. So, you know, I really felt that I had to succeed in business as a businessman and to succeed in writing as a poet. And so I wanted to keep the lives separate. And it wasn't really until I'd been in the business world a number of years when Esquire magazine decided that they wanted to do a piece on me for part of this special issue they did called the Esquire Register, Men and Women Under 40 Who Are Changing America, that my cover was blown. In fact, I tried to convince Esquire not to run the article, but they said it wasn't my choice. And so at that point, you know, I was outed.
When after you left the corporate world and started writing on a more full-time basis, you said that, you know, in your own way, you missed the camaraderie of office life. How did you feel about becoming an arts administrator when you were asked to become the head of the National Endowment for the Arts?
I accepted the job in fear and trembling. I have to say that I did not seek this job, and in fact, I turned it down, I turned down the possibility of interviewing for it 2 years ago, and said I didn't even want to be considered for it because I'm not a political person. I'm an artist, and I have no political ambitions, and I was, you know, happy supporting myself as a writer. I was very successful at it, and it was really only after they chose a man named Michael Hammond, who died 8 days in office, and during the same time, my own father passed away. I was with him to the very end. I was at his bed when he died. That and after September 11th, that when I was approached about the job again, that I agreed to consider it. And as corny as it may sound, after my father's death, after 9/11, you know, I thought that, you know, my father didn't want to go off and fight World War II. I mean, he was not a warrior, but he spent 4 years as a radio operator and a dive bomber, which was a fairly dangerous job, because he felt it was the right thing to do. And so I felt that if indeed my country needed me to come to the National Endowment for the Arts and to try to rebuild this incredibly valuable institution that had been so roughly treated by history, that I had a certain, pardon me for saying this, patriotic obligation to do this. I had never served my country, and I was being asked to, so I should do it. And so I girded up my loins like a man and came to Washington.
Have you taken a stand on the so-called culture wars and on the funding of art with sexual content, transgressive art?
Well, the controversy that surrounded the National Endowment involved a lot of things that were really outside of the endowment. And some of these things actually have been looked at by the Supreme Court, and they came to a decision which I think is the right one, which is that the National Endowment for the Arts makes no decision based on content or point of view. We make our decisions in terms of artistic excellence. That being said, you know, I do think that one of the things that the Arts Endowment needs to do is to think of itself as a national institution that exists to serve the American people, not as a regional institution that serves the arts establishment. And I think that the things that got the Arts Endowment into trouble, this is not an opinion I think held by everyone, were not the controversies, but it was a basic dilemma at the center of the endowment. In its very distinguished history, the endowment had really never been able to serve most of America. There was entire portions of the country that got very little from it, especially rural areas, semi-rural areas, smaller cities, the inner cities, and that we had not done a good job at the endowment of demonstrating our public value. I mean, the most important thing that I'm trying to do at the endowment, you know, is to make sure that we spend the money in an egalitarian and democratic way, that we reach the entire country with programs that people, you know, feel are of value.
You want to give an example?
I think the program that I'm most proud of at the moment is a new venture called Shakespeare in American Communities. This is the largest tour of Shakespeare in American history. We have 6 regional theater companies that we are sending on a tour of over 100 mid-sized and smaller cities. These are mostly cities that don't have live full-time professional drama on their own. We're also visiting about 1,000 high schools, and we're bringing really the best new productions of Shakespeare to communities that might not normally get this sort of fare. Now, in addition, we are working with the Department of Defense, who is funding us to bring a 7th company to tour military bases and the communities surrounding the military bases, which are mainly isolated rural communities. I'm enormously enthusiastic about this program because I think it brings art of the highest quality to the broadest possible cross-section of Americans.
Well, it sounds like a great program. But, you know, what you were saying about funding art that reaches the largest audience, you know, raises a larger question about what kind of art should be funded. And one argument would be art that reaches the largest audience. But another argument, and I'd like your opinion on this argument, is that it should just be art that maybe won't reach a large audience. For example, art that might be considered, you know, radical or fringy at this moment, but that is so good and so original that it's going to, if it's funded and allowed to flourish, it can go on and affect the mainstream maybe a few years down the line. Good examples would be, say, the music of Steve Reich and Philip Glass, which were considered very avant-garde and kind of like odd, and were very much like in the avant-garde music and the avant-garde gallery scene when they started performing. And now, I mean, TV commercials use music inspired by them, or maybe it's actually their music. Who knows? But you see my point, that sometimes the stuff that seems very fringy in its moment and isn't going to reach a large audience in that particular moment will eventually have a profound effect on American culture.
I'm not sure I entirely accept that. That is the theory of the avant-garde. That's a theory of art that was articulated really in the early 20th century in a kind of vanguard of the avant-garde. And to a certain degree it applies, but I think by and large, most art, you know, has some direct appeal. People may not entirely understand why they like it or why they don't. But, you know, I am a real believer in the power of art. And the one thing I refuse to do as chairman of the National Endowment for the Arts is to condescend to the American people, to think that they are somehow incapable of appreciating and engaging with the best art of its kind. I mean, I look back to the WPA era in American arts, an enormously visionary program during the Depression, you know, in which the best new artists, you know, got involved in the creation of public works. And I do not believe, in fact, I refuse to believe that artistic excellence and democratic accessibility are mutually exclusive categories.
Well, let me ask you another question that I think there's a lot of disagreement about within the arts world, and that is, should most money go toward funding institutions or go toward funding individual artists? And there's, you know, arguments that are very compelling on both sides. What's your take on that?
Well, you know, I'm very practical about this, and I'll give you an example. I mean, I have written 2 opera libretti with 2 composers, and I could give, let's say, a $20,000 grant to 2 composers to write an opera. And they may or may not be able to get these operas produced, and the money would probably help them, you know, move the project along. Or I could give $40,000, the sum of these 2 grants, to an opera company, require matching funds, and we've learned that when we give money to an institution, they can usually leverage it to be about 6 times the amount. Take that $40,000, turn it into about $250,000, put on a new opera, so there is a composer who actually gets it to produce. He or she gets the benefit of that. You know, the conductor gets the benefit of producing a new opera. The company gets a new experience in terms of their own maturation as a company. The musicians get work. The singers get work. The director, the set designers, the costume designers get work. And the audience gets the experience of seeing and hearing a new work in their own community. Now, we do have individual grants still in a number of categories, to poets, fiction writers, translators, creative nonfiction, traditional artists, and jazz artists. But the other support that we give goes towards institutions, and I think that's probably the most effective and efficient way of as it were, bringing the artist and the audience together.
Some of the people who led the charge against federal funding for the arts also were very anti-gay, most notably perhaps Newt Gingrich. As you know, there are a lot of gay men and women in the arts world. Is there any hint of pressure on you and the NEA to limit the amount of money that goes either toward gay-themed art or the funding of overtly gay artists?
None whatsoever. The National Endowment for the Arts exists to serve all Americans. Once someone tells me that there's a class of Americans that we're not supposed to serve or not supposed to become partners with, I stop listening. But in all honesty, no one has mentioned anything of this. I think it's a fear that is an unfounded one. And I am, to the tips of my fingers, someone who is an egalitarian. And I believe that a public agency must serve all the public. That's the same way that I want to bring Shakespeare to the military. In the 38 years of the endowment's history, we've never done a large program for the military. There are 1.4 million Americans in uniform. They don't tend to come from overprivileged backgrounds. You add their families together, it's over 3 million people. They tend to live in semi-rural areas where there's not, you know, many cultural resources. We need to do something for them. Otherwise, we're not really serving America.
Are you thinking about the Shakespeare plays about the military, like Henry V?
Yeah, we're bringing Macbeth actually on the military tour because.
But you're actually doing a military tour.
We are. I mean, I went to the Pentagon, and I had a meeting with the Undersecretary of Defense, and I told him, "Sir, I believe I'm probably the first chairman of the National Endowment for the Arts who's ever come to the Pentagon," and he agreed that I indeed probably was, and I said, "I know I'm the only chairman who has a sister currently on active duty because she was called up out of the reserves." I've got one brother who's a jazz musician, one brother who is a DJ rap music expert, and a sister who's a jock, and she went into the Navy. And he said, yeah, I was probably the only chairman that had a sister on active duty. I said, well, there's two firsts. I want to make a third first today. I want you to help, get the Department of Defense to fund a military tour of Shakespeare. And I'm happy to say that with the support of Senator Ted Stevens of Alaska, that now seems to be becoming a reality, and we're going to be bringing a tour of Shakespeare to the military community, to 16 bases and all the surrounding schools, and I'm really very proud of that. It's a historical first.
Interesting. Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
It's been a great pleasure.
Dina Gioia is the chair of the National Endowment for the Arts. His latest book of poetry is called Interrogations at Noon.